Hello, it's Tim. Here's the third of four episodes we recorded featuring papers from economic policy, papers on European and global issues. If you haven't discovered the first two episodes that we published last week, check them out after you finish this one.
Under current policies, just integrating Europe fully would make the euro the anchor currency.
The dollar has been the currency that we rely on in a crisis. My guest today has a new explanation for why that is and what it would take for the euro to inherit that role. Welcome to a series of podcasts featuring the papers that were commissioned for the second Economic Policy Papers on European and Global Issues Conference that was held in June 2026. I'm Tim Phillips. The dollar has been the world's anchor currency since the end of the Second World War. The dollar also sits on one side of 89% of all currency trades. But US policy and global geopolitical changes mean that we can now reasonably ask, how long will it remain dominant and what currency might inherit its status? Tarek Hassan of Boston University and CPR is one of a team of researchers that has been asking those questions. He joins me now to share some of the answers they found. Tarek, welcome.
Hi, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here.
The dollar is considered a safe haven currency. It's the anchor currency at the moment. What is the function of a currency like this in a time of economic stress?
Yeah, so the US dollar, the euro, the yen, and a few other currencies have this property that they appreciate in value when things go wrong in the world economy. So when there's a crisis like the global financial crisis or COVID or something else goes badly wrong, they appreciate relative to all other currencies. And from the perspective of an investor, that means they're the safest store of value. When things go wrong, they retain their value or even increase in value relative to other currencies. And that's why we call them safe haven currencies. Now, many other currencies don't have that property. Like the Australian dollar, for example, tends to depreciate when things go wrong. So that makes it risky. And the US dollar is the champion or the superstar of the safe haven currencies that kind of appreciates the most when things go wrong.
How did the dollar get to be the superstar, the first among equals?
Yeah, I think that's very important to think about. And we argue in our paper that it wasn't an accident. It really just follows from two facts. The first fact is that the US economy is the largest economy in the world. And second, it's deeply integrated with world trade. So goods flow in and out of the US whenever something happens. And because the US is so big, whatever happens in the US moves prices everywhere. So the same things that make the US dollar appreciate also make Americans import more goods. When the US dollar appreciates, Americans feel richer and they import more. Mm-hmm. And so when the US dollar appreciates, the price of traded goods in the world also goes up. So that very simple relationship, the fact that demand by US consumers has a very large effect on the price of traded goods in the world, that is fundamentally what makes the US dollar the safest of the safe haven currencies.
And is there an advantage to the US in being the world's anchor here?
So there are many advantages. Mm-hmm. The biggest of those is what politicians often call the exorbitant privilege. Exorbitant privilege is just a fancy way of saying Americans can borrow very cheaply. In some European countries, you can go into a bank and they'll ask you, do you want to open the bank account in local currency or in US dollars? Mm-hmm. And typically, the US dollar account will have the lower interest rate. Why does it have the lower interest rate? Well, maybe because you feel a little bit safer putting the money in there. So what that means for US consumers, the US government, and US firms is that international investors are willing, maybe you, actually, I don't know if you have a dollar account, but many people do. Mm-hmm. So international investors are willing to lend to Americans cheaply. And that cheap money does a lot of interesting things to the US economy, basically means lots of investment is coming in. It means US firms can invest more, buy more machines, develop fancier AI models and so forth. And US consumers can borrow more cheaply to buy houses. So it has lots of effects like that. It means there's a lot of capital inflows to the US, and it becomes the center of the world monetary system. So let me explain that briefly. Because the dollar is safe and because US interest rates are so low, other countries look at that and they think, oh, I want some of that. How can I get some of that? And the way that you get some of that is by stabilizing your exchange rate relative to the US dollar. Two-thirds of countries in the world have a policy where their central banks make sure that when the dollar appreciates, their currencies also appreciate. Why are they doing that? Well, to make their currencies safer from the perspective of foreign investors. And that is the key thing. So that makes the US dollar the world's only anchor currency.
Now, lately, some commentators have been questioning whether the dollar's exorbitant privilege status is quite as secure as it used to be. What indicators are they seeing that make them say that? What movements are they pointing to?
Yeah, so there's many sort of long-term changes where people are saying, oh, well, China's getting bigger and so forth, and, you know, isn't something going to happen? But the key moment really was in April 2025, what Donald Trump called Liberation Day.
Oh, we talk about Liberation Day so much still, and we always will, won't we? Yeah,
that's quite all right. So Liberation Day was a terrible day for the dollar.
Uh-huh.
And this is something that only economics nerds, I think, picked up on. But I got very nervous on that day. And the reason I got very nervous is that normally, as I said, when global markets panic, the dollar appreciates. And that was not the case on Liberation Day. On Liberation Day, when the US put on all these tariffs, the dollar actually depreciated. And after that, so we look at some details in the financial data that basically you can measure. When people get more nervous, does the dollar appreciate or depreciate?
Mm-hmm.
And typically, when people get more nervous, the dollar used to appreciate. And then during that period, all of a sudden that broke down. So that made a lot of people nervous. At the same time, US interest rates rose relative to that of other rich countries, and US stocks fell more than foreign stocks. So that means US treasuries, US equities, and the dollar all lost value at once. And that is how normally how markets treat a risky currency, not a safe one.
Is there a conventional wisdom as to why things are changing?
Different people have different views. So most of this discussion usually focuses on what I would call institutional features. How easy is it to buy and sell US treasuries? How much of currency volume or currency exchanges flow through the US dollar? So, for example, there's this interesting thing that when you want to exchange a Mexican peso into a Hungarian forint, typically first you take the peso, make it into a US dollar, and then you make it into a forint. People talk about which currency oil is being invoiced in and so forth. I would call these institutional forces. They're important because they can be very slow moving and they can lock in the anchor status for a while. But we argue that really those are all symptoms of one big thing, which is the US economy is the biggest economy in the world. And as a result, it has the safest currency and everything else follows from that. That's our view.
So in this research, Tarek, you are arguing that this other factor, this bigger idea that the US is the world's largest economy is determining its anchor status, that this size determines safeness. Is that right?
Yeah. So let me qualify that a little bit. And this is where it gets interesting, is it's not enough to be big, but you have to be big in a way that makes you important for the world economy when something bad happens. So we call this effective size.
Uh-huh.
So it's like how big is the weight of US consumers in determining the world price of traded goods? So how much are Americans knocking around the world price of traded goods? And this effective size depends on two things. It depends on how big you actually are, but it also depends on how open you are and how open you are both for trade in goods and trade in financial investment. So let me explain this. So think of like a shock that makes the US dollar appreciate. The reason the dollar is safe is because that same shock, when the dollar appreciates, Americans buy more, and therefore the price of traded goods in the world goes up.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say I now put a tariff wall around the US. I basically tax imports at a very high rate. Well, then, you know, whatever makes the dollar appreciate is going to make Americans want to import more, but they won't be able to because they have to pay high taxes on these imports. So that's why a tariff shrinks your effective size. And if it shrinks your effective size enough, it makes your currency less safe, and it's going to reduce the incentive of foreign countries to stabilize their currencies against the US dollar.
Right, and US policy at the moment raises tariffs and is discouraging some forms of cross-border investment. Are you basically saying this is reducing the effective size of the US economy?
Yes, exactly. So tariffs isolate the US from world goods markets. So American shocks no longer spill into world prices the way that they used to. And then as a result, the dollar loses its tendency to rise in bad times. We can measure this. So I said people got nervous around Liberation Day. And according to our estimates, today's average tariff on US imports and exports is about 12%. And that already raises US interest rates by half a percentage point, or 0.4 percentage points, actually.
Now, you've modeled this in the paper. What policy levers are you investigating to consider, well, which other countries might inherit that anchor status from the dollar if that were to happen?
The European Union, or the euro, is sort of in a unique position there because the European Union can actually do a lot of stuff to make itself more safer, to make the euro safer, and to make the euro a more attractive anchor for foreign currencies. And the reason for this is that Europe actually is quite a big economy. It's just that the euro is used just in a core of countries. So Europeans are very used to integrating and enlarging the European Union. And the single most effective policy to make the euro safer would be to integrate the European economies more and to enlarge the European Union. So the European Union has a surprisingly large number of countries already somewhat integrated with it. The UK is one example, Switzerland, Norway. Well,
there's some history there.
Turkey. So there is actually a large chunk of world GDP that are sort of hangers on to the European Union, but not fully integrated. Full integration among these countries would make the euro a much more attractive anchor. So the first policy is deepening integration and enlargement. The second is maintaining openness to world trade. Mm-hmm. And the third is maintaining an open capital account.
Right. Now, we usually, when we're having this discussion about what will inherit the role of the world's anchor currency, think about China. Why are you thinking of the Eurozone rather than the Chinese economy?
So I think there's two reasons. So the first is the greater European economy is actually larger than the Chinese economy and the US economy by a bit of a margin. So if you integrated all these countries, you would have the largest bloc. The second is that China has a set of policies that make it very unattractive currently as an anchor currency and also make the renminbi risky, not safe. I've explained why putting on tariffs makes your currency less attractive or less safe. The same thing, and this is sort of a little harder to think about, but the same thing happens when you put in capital controls. So capital controls are policies that prevent international investors from freely investing in China, putting their money in China and moving it back out. And at the same time, policies that prevent Chinese households from investing abroad. So if you look at what Chinese households invest in, it's almost exclusively Chinese assets. It's very difficult for Chinese investors to move their money abroad. And so there's rules about like no more than $50,000 a year. And so there's certain tricks around this. If you meet Chinese students at US universities, they're very aware of these issues and try to find ways around it and so forth. But the fact is that if you have a closed capital account, that stops. So let's say there's a shock that makes the renminbi appreciate. Because Chinese investors are not invested abroad in the same degree as US investors are, that stops this shock from increasing the number of imports into China. Forces that make the renminbi appreciate don't knock around world demand for traded goods as much as US shocks do. And that's a direct effect of this closed capital account policy. And while the capital account is closed, you're just a very unattractive anchor. So it's almost like China has the inverse of the US trade policy and much worse. Like it's like having a much bigger tariff, basically.
You were talking about the current level of euro integration, the policies that we have there. Can we say what level of tariffs, if US tariffs kept escalating, would cause other countries to peg their currencies to the euro rather than to the dollar?
This is kind of interesting, and it's kind of surprising when you dig into the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing I should explain is that although there was a lot of noise about US tariffs, they're really nowhere near as large as the administration is pretending and as the press coverage would suggest. So after all of this sort of like, you know, Liberation Day and back and forth and exemptions and retaliations, the average tax on US imports and exports, and here you need to count both the tariff that the US is putting on and the tariff that foreigners put on the US. The average tariff on US imports and exports is somewhere around 12%. So it's actually not astronomical.
It's nowhere near the 120% that are being thrown around, yeah.
Yes, not at all. Which, by the way, would be massively against US national interest.
Yes, I mean, absolutely.
All kinds of different dimensions, including this one. So the average tariff currently on US imports and exports is 12%. We estimate that if that number rose to 26%, that would make the euro safer than the dollar under current policies. Roughly doubling what the Trump administration is doing now would essentially erode the dollar status enough that people would start stabilizing against the euro. That would happen very rapidly.
Ah, right. This isn't a slow evolution. This is something that suddenly this becomes the best thing to do.
So what our model says is that you wake up and you wake up in the morning, okay? And maybe you're one of these people who has a dollar account at the bank.
Yeah.
And something has happened and makes you feel, oh, the dollar is super risky now. What are you going to do? You're going to go to the bank and you're going to take the money out of that account and put it maybe into a different account. So these things can happen very fast. Now, there are some things that people say are going to slow this down, and we haven't modeled those explicitly, like trade invoicing is in dollars and the Fed's market for treasuries is very deep and so forth. But, you know, if you go back in history, like these shifts do happen. It takes a couple of years, but they do happen relatively fast. It's not like a decades long process.
So now let's imagine that that scenario that you talked about earlier happens, and there was this deeper economic integration in Europe. So the UK joins in, the European Free Trade Area and the accession countries that are waiting to join the EU. What level of tariffs would then cause this switch?
I should say that when we say they join in, it doesn't mean you fly the flag.
No.
It just means that you integrate economically. And these are sort of things that are somewhat boring, right? So it doesn't mean you need to have a European flag on your number plate. It means that goods and services have to flow freely between the UK and the rest of Europe. So the numbers are kind of striking. The Eurozone's effective size today, the Eurozone's about 15% of world GDP.
Mm-hmm.
Integrating all of the existing EU fully, that doesn't mean expanding the euro, but just making Hungary as integrated with the Eurozone as Germany, that would raise it to 17%. Add the UK, the European Free Trade Association, that's like Norway and Switzerland, you get to something like 22%. And what that does is it drops the tipping point that I mentioned earlier, where the euro becomes more attractive. It drops this tipping point from 26% tariffs between the US and the rest of the world to 6%. So that means under current policies, everybody keeps doing what they're doing, just integrating Europe fully would make the euro the anchor currency.
Gosh. And to be clear, that doesn't mean that Hungary has to adopt the euro instead of the forint and the UK has to give up the pound and then become part of the eurozone. It doesn't mean that.
No. So I want to be a little careful here. So for an economist, what your banknotes look like is completely irrelevant. So it doesn't matter whether you have a king on there or a bridge, doesn't matter. Whether you need to exchange them when you go from the UK to Germany also doesn't matter.
Uh-huh.
What matters is, so do you have a common monetary policy, basically? And even that is not super important. So in our estimate, a common monetary policy is about 1/5 of that integration gain, but 4/5, so 80% of the gain just comes from real economic integration, meaning if you're a business in Turkey, you're a business in the UK, you can freely ship your goods and services around. There's a common fiscal policy, and that's enough for most of this gain. And these are somewhat boring economic policies. It's not like You have to change national identity to get there.
On the other hand, the political reality is very often that there are voices within Europe advocating copying the US stance, raising tariffs and protecting itself, closing off from the world in that way. Is that going to be good for the euro's status as an anchor currency?
No. If Europe now starts walling itself off from world trade, it shrinks its effective size and it's going to make the euro less safe. Making the euro less safe means European interest rates are going to go up, investment is going to flow out of Europe, and wages are going to fall. So walling Europe off is not a good idea. Can I do a quick sidebar here? Just also Econ 101, which has been irritating me massively. It's like, so we teach a course in trade policy at BU. So if you're an advanced undergraduate, you can take a course on trade policy. And effectively what that course on trade policy is, it's an instruction manual for how to best screw the foreign countries.
Oh, right. Okay?
We teach you how to raise tariffs to maximize your national advantage. So now you remember like Trump came out with this plaque and it said like this country this much, that country that much.
Uh-huh, yeah.
If you showed up with that in an exam, so like this is how you want to screw foreign countries, that is not how it works. That's like an immediate fail.
You're not going to get maximum marks for that, no.
No, and let me explain why. Number one, it's not in the national interest to put a blanket tariff on everything. The best example of this is like rare earths. Remember this?
Mm-hmm.
The US put like a massive tariff on China, like 100% tariff. And then the next day, we're like, wait a minute, what about the rare earths that only come from China? Well, actually, we want the prices of those to be lower, right? You're supposed to put the tariff on the good that is least elastic. So that means that you're supposed to have a plaque, not with the names of countries on it, but the names of goods.
Mm-hmm.
And those numbers, first of all, are going to be small for most countries. And let me kind of cut this speech short. My point is that even if you are like the most pig-headed nationalist, you would not follow that US trade policy because simply it's shooting yourself directly in the foot, even before we start talking about eroding the dollar status in the world.
So let me bring China into this one again. We're talking about a two-way competition for anchor status between the euro and the dollar. From what you said earlier, it sounds like China would have quite a long way to move in policy terms to make this a three-way fight.
Yes. And I think surprisingly, there's not a lot of debate on this.
Uh-huh.
China is basically what we would call under financial repression, in the sense that people can't move their money out. It's stuck in China. And that actually causes all kinds of problems like the real estate bubbles and things like that. If China wanted to make its currency the anchor currency, it would have to back off that completely to make it a three-way race. And I don't think we have a very good sense for how hard that would be to do. My sense is it would be a big change, unclear how feasible it is.
Now, if you were going to market this idea within Europe, many people would be skeptical. What advantages could you say that there were to the European economy if we were to wake up at some point in the near future and the euro was the anchor currency?
So it has two sets of advantages. So the first sets of advantages are lower interest rates. So we have massive government debts in Europe currently. And if you lower interest rates in Europe by 1 percentage point or 2 percentage points, that has a massive effect on the budget. We're talking about hundreds of billions of euros per year that governments would save just on the lower interest rates on government debt. Add to that higher investment and as a result, higher wages for Europeans. So it's a big deal. I think the second set of advantages of being the anchor currency is that essentially once you become the anchor currency, that puts in motion all these institutional changes that put your currency at the center of the world monetary system. That comes, as the US has demonstrated, with an awful lot of control over other countries by basically cutting individuals off from dealing in euros, by controlling essentially the flow of capital in the world. So the geopolitical advantages to this that we're not modeling here, but that I think people think about a lot. Yeah, so I think it would be a big deal. I should add one institutional detail that I think is genuinely important. That is the lack of euro bonds. We have a few of those floating around, but we still have this thing that European government debt is like the Italian flavor, the German flavor, the French flavor, and so forth. So one policy proposal out there currently is that the big push now to sort of invest in European defense, that that should be financed by borrowing at the European level and not at the national level, just so you can have more European euro bonds, so bonds that have just a European sign on it floating around. And there's a sense that that might be a really helpful policy to make the euro a more attractive anchor. Again, that's not in our model here, but I do agree with that assessment that that's an important step.
Tarek, thank you very much for talking about it.
Yeah, thank you, Tim, for having me.
Now, if you want to read this paper, it is called Openness, Integration and the International Monetary Order, and the authors Tarek Hassan, Thomas Mertens, Jingyu Wang and Tony Chang. It is going to be published in Economic Policy Papers on European and Global Issues, the next edition. This has been a Talk Normal production. Megan Bieber was the assistant producer, and the sound editor was Andrei Zolgaryov.